And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
And I am David.
And today, before we get into, we have many things to cover today, both our actual topic and some emails. But before we even do that, I have two things that I want to promote. One,
ooh,
you guys
promotion.
Promotion. I know, right? I'm going to promote them from lieutenant commander to full commander because they passed the command test and ordered Geordi to their death. Am I getting Star Trek meta enough for us here?
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys may remember a little while ago there was a kerfuffle over the Star Trek Parallel Lives comic that was a comic that took place in an alternate universe of the JJ universe where the characters' genders were flipped. And so
right,
like,
and we had a lot of people being, you know, D-bags in the chat rooms discussing it and making some really, really disgusting remarks about it.
Yeah, so basically, you know, it only really got attention because a bunch of whiny crybabies were like, "You make Kirk a woman!" Wah! That was what they sounded like.
That was beautiful, Oren. Thank you for that.
But, so now we actually have had, Jara Hodge has actually read it, and she has reviewed it and given us her thoughts. So you can check that out on the Trekkie Feminist, which is her Tumblr, and it's very good. And her review is very clever, as always. And I think I will have to get it myself and take a look now. And then the other thing that I want to promote out there is another Tumblr called the Pixie Recaps, which is a really, really funny set of Voyager recaps done by a blogger who goes by the name of Pixie. She has a real name, but I don't have it in front of me right now. But
she also does
a
bunch of recaps of Once Upon a Time episodes, which, as I understand it, is how she got started in this whole mess. They are very funny as well if you're into that thing.
Yeah, so if you just look up Pixie Voyager recaps, you will find them. They are hilarious.
Hilarity will ensue.
Well, and the thing that kind of sets it apart from some other things is it's based on screenshots, and then there's like text on top of the screenshots, and it's just interesting and funny, and I haven't really seen anything like that before.
And for someone who's just using screen caps entirely for their thing, she has a very good sense of comic timing from what I can see.
Yeah, she totally does. So I've enjoyed them, and I have started linking to them. You can also look, if you look at the All Things Trek Facebook page, you know, shout out for the All Things Trek Facebook page, I guess. I've linked both there and to Jara's review. So you should check both of those things out because they are good. And we will try to get Pixie on the show once we find out what her real name is and contact her. But, all right, so next up, we have several emails. So I'm going to launch
into... So many emails.
Yes, we have like 2 weeks worth of emails, so we'll launch into our first one here. It's from a fellow who goes by MVH, and it says, and the topic is a murder mystery episode that you missed. And it says, "Hi, just thought I would remind you of a crime-related episode of Deep Space Nine that would fit into your latest episode about crime and punishment. I mean the Field of Fire episode, where Esri investigates a string of mysterious onboard station... Of mysterious murders onboard the station, and bring forth the memories of the suppressed murdering host Duran to aid her." So, which is basically like Hannibal Lecter in Star Trek. Spoiler, turns out it was a Vulcan driven over the edge by PTSD from having his crew lost in battle against the Dominion and started murdering people who publicly expressed happiness. He was also using a microtransporter attached to a sniper rifle that allowed bullets to beam to the victim from just about anywhere. Guess you can just replicate those. Seems dangerous. Also, Vulcan telepathic range came up. In the episode Sarek, we learned that very old Vulcans can suffer from a disorder known as Bendai syndrome, which causes them to broadcast intense emotions that can trigger violent outbursts in nearby non-Vulcans. Other Vulcans can generally resist it, without the need for touch. On a side note, you mentioned boarding actions and such in a recent Zindi episode. That kind of reminds me of a Stargate Atlantis episode, not Star Trek, I know, bear with me, where they use the Asgard transporters to beam nukes directly onto multiple enemy ships and detonate them to great effect, until the Reapers developed a transport inhibitor of some kind anyway. I've always wondered why transporter technology was not weaponized more in Star Trek. They often find ways to beam people into or out of shielded locations, but they almost never seem to think of using it to deliver weapons, or maybe just some raw antimatter. Starfleet might find some tactics, such tactics distasteful, but surely other factions would not care about that. I could imagine a ship with high-powered transporter arrays in place of conventional weapons, combined with some kind of shield draining technology, it could just dematerialize enemy ships outright and not bother to rematerialize them or saving the pattern. I guess the battles would not look as cool, though.
Sincerely, well, there was that...
I was just going to say, sincerely, MVH. That is the end of the email.
Well, there was that one time that the Captain Kirk and specifically Scotty weaponized a transporter by beaming all those tribbles onto the Klingon ship. I mean, that's like an act of war. That's an impressive act
of tribble-based warfare.
The UN is looking into that. That may constitute a war crime. We're not sure. And Voyager also did something sort of similar in the episode Dark Frontier when they beamed a transporter. They beamed a torpedo onto a small Borg ship and destroyed it that way.
Good grief.
Yeah, which is... like, on the one hand, I can see why people think that the transporter should be used that way, but on the other hand, I wish they wouldn't, because it's sort of like, why don't they do that all the time, becomes the question. Because, as he pointed out, they keep talking about how they can beam through shields, which seems odd that they would never use that for a, you know, more permanent solution, as it were.
I just realized that with the microtransporter attached to a phaser, though, we've got the perfect explanation for, like, the kind of... magic bullet conspiracy theories, and I think we just found a new Kennedy conspiracy theory, just like that.
Time travelers with microtransporter. But
the Vulcans killed Kennedy. It all makes sense.
That's like my mind. I'm doing the GIF where the mind is blown and my head explodes. But here's the other thing about the
scanners.
It makes sense in theory that you could beam, you know, matter. You could beam like living matter. You could beam mechanical devices, so why not just beam bombs everywhere? But it made me think, like, why wouldn't they do that? And then it made me think of on the episode of TNG, The Most Toys, where there was that Veron T disruptor that they said was banned, and there was like only 5 in existence, and it's like
Geneva Convention got to it.
Right, and it made me, even back then on that episode, I thought, okay, they're saying this is banned, and then other times we see like David Marcus, when he used that proto matter, it's like they say, you know, there's certain things that are banned or outlawed or not, everybody agrees to not do it. And that made me think, who oversees that? You know, it's like if that guy had the Veron T disruptor, like whose law is he breaking? And so maybe that is another thing that would apply to the transporters. Like it's so easy to do it, but it's so horrible or so, you know, insidious or just bad that everybody's like, okay, let's not do this, you know?
And just who's in charge of enforcing those Romulan ale laws? We have to wonder.
Well, this is an interesting topic. We talked about this a little bit when Elise was on the show about the polite fiction that is international law, because there's really no such thing as international law, because law is by definition passed by a government. And if there's no, you know, governing body that can enforce those laws, they really don't exist. And, you know, so here on Earth, we have the UN, which kind of oversees international law until one country decides it doesn't want to anymore. And then it's like, oh, then the UN can't really do anything because the UN doesn't
have... It works up until it doesn't, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, David, you brought up the disruptor that they have in The Most Toys. That particular one, that seemed a lot like basically the flamethrower of Star Trek, where basically everyone agreed to stop using it because of how terrible it was, but also because it isn't really that effective. Like, it's horrible. Like, it murders people and is this terribly painful way to die, and, like, you should never use it. It's the same thing with the flamethrower. But, like, in modern warfare, it isn't really a super valuable tool. It's really just, it's scary, but it isn't practical, which is why people were willing to not use it. And, you know, for example, like, landmines and cluster bombs have also been declared, you know, cruel weapons that you shouldn't use, but people still use those because they're very practical and useful, whereas everyone has kind of agreed, okay, flamethrowers, we won't use flamethrowers. Those don't really serve any practical purpose. Whereas the transporter gun is just mad OP. Like, they don't use that because if they did, it would be, like, they'd be unstoppable. Like, a bunch of Jem'Hadar.
Yeah, it wouldn't be fair then, would it?
Yeah, you know, a bunch of Jem'Hadar would board the station, and then they would all just die because transporter bullets. It'd be terrible. But it is part of the whole, like, why do they even bother with phasers, right? Because there seem to be so many more competent weapons out there.
Because they're just a standard issue one.
Yeah, I suppose. He also mentioned the Vulcan telepath range, and that has always been kind of inconsistent. There's, like, one TOS episode where Spock can, like, do a mind meld through a wall. And it's a little bit like, that seems odd. I don't think, come on, Spock. But he's right. The range of that has fluctuated a little bit here and there. All right, so let us move on to our next email. Hold on just one second. And this one is from our friend Elise, our Star Trek lawyer, attorney at law.
Yay!
Dong dong. Or was that Law and Order sound thing?
Yeah, I got it.
And of course, now I'm having trouble accessing. Here we go. She says, I had a follow-up on the topic of diplomatic immunity, which we didn't really talk about to a great degree. Diplomatic immunity only works as long as the community who wants to prosecute you subscribes to that theory, like the legal fiction of international law. Many cultures encountered on Star Trek don't have established diplomatic relationships with the Federation, so why would they have diplomatic immunity? There is probably something like it among Federation worlds, but there is often far less friction there shown on Trek. It also occurs to me that a sovereign entity has the power to waive diplomatic immunity, and given the Federation's prime directive, they may have a standing waiver on such things. Which is kind of the attitude of, our guys would never do anything wrong, so they don't need diplomatic immunity. Which, you know, I'm sure is not a big favor to Wesley when he's, you know, being threatened with execution because he had to stand on the grass.
He's someone who needs a little more diplomatic immunity. Although, does he really count as a diplomat in that situation?
Well,
I mean, he's just there to scout the planet to see if it's fun. That's literally the assignment he's given.
Well, and that's the thing that I thought of in that episode and just in general before is, like, diplomatic immunity, is that just across the board? You know, in certain scenarios, any random civilian or Starfleet officer would be covered by it, like an insurance policy or something? Or, like, on other cop shows and movies or stuff, you see that, like, here comes the Russian, you know, consulate, and they have the car that has the little flags on it, and they're like, we can't touch him, he's got diplomatic immunity. And that's because he's specifically a diplomat or a certain role or position, not just, oh, he's from the other country, so he's covered. I always kind of thought Picard and Kirk and all them, they weren't really diplomats because we didn't say Ambassador Picard all the time, right? He didn't have the credentials or didn't do that. So I just always wondered, would they be covered by that or not?
Well, there are.
If so, do they get, like, extra Enterprise parking for being, you know, diplomats?
They can park the Enterprise wherever they want. They've got the little flags on the front. But, I mean, there are certain episodes where they are engaged in official, like, diplomatic action, and you would think that at that point the other culture or whoever they're having a, you know, they're diplomatizing with would be less likely to want to arrest them because it might cause problems with the Federation, but maybe not. Maybe they're just not interested. Like, you know, sometimes
that does
happen.
I guess we'll never know.
All right, so we have one more normal email, and then we have a voicemail. So this one is from WWDS, my bad. And Grace, would you go ahead and read it for us?
Absolutely. Again, this email is from WWDS, and she writes to us saying, your show on Crime and Punishment in Trek was very interesting, though also difficult to listen to. I found myself wondering if Ship's Diplomat would be a good role to round out the science officer character. Regarding psychiatric terms and the law and the character, the Bajoran murderer with telepathy, I haven't gotten to TNG yet, Orin started to ask if he was psychotic and then began to discuss psychopathy. Psychosis and psychopathy are two different things, the first involving perceptions or beliefs that vary greatly from accepted reality, and the second involving acting in harmful way towards society related to a lack of empathy. Some terms in psychiatry are completely different from those used in legal terms. For example, insanity is not a definition in psychiatry, but in the legal system only. I just wanted to expand on that. Elise Abramson can correct me if I'm wrong. My experience comes from a few college psychology courses and being a mental health care consumer. I also wanted to throw my opinion in the ring that I would not mind calling Earth Sol 3 in the least. Peace and long life, WWDS.
Right, Earth is now Sol 3. That makes sense. I mean, if we're going to call it, like, Cardassia 4 or whatever, like, we don't care what they call it. We should probably just drop the idea of planets having independent names in the first place.
Well, yeah, third planet of the solar system. Why not?
Now, with the other things that she mentioned, as much as I would love to have the science officer have more to do, I don't know if the diplomatic officer really would mesh well with the science officer position. I mean, I'm sure Dax could do it, because Dax was a science officer.
It could work, but we'd have to see it in action to be sure.
I'm just saying the training you get to be, you know, a botanist or a physicist or what have you is not necessarily going to overlap with the training you get to be a diplomat. Because, you know, when you're being a scientist, your goal is to get to the truth, right? Like, your goal is to cut through all the false information and find out what's actually happening. But when you're a diplomat, a lot of that is sort of just, you know, dealing with other people's lies. And if you call them on their lies, they're going to get mad at you.
It almost seems like it would be a little, obviously, to me, I think it should be a separate position. Like, you know, there's a science officer all the down the line, and then here's our ambassador who's assigned to the ship. But if we were going to try to blend it with something, I think it would probably be best with the counselor, because they're dealing with, like, emotions and psychology and that type of thing, and then they could apply that to the diplomatic talks or, you know, when they go into debates or that type of thing. But I thought it'd be cool to see, since when TNG added a counselor role, and that's basically, like, all she does is supposedly counsel people, you know, being a therapist, counselor, it would have been cool to see other positions added, like an ambassador or, you know, and maybe they just sit on their thumbs a lot of times, but then something comes up and they're like, then they spring into action. It's like, I need to take over. Here's the scenario that we need to fix.
Yeah, and I mean, the idea that Troy was supposed to be the ship's diplomatic officer would have made a lot of sense, and there's a couple episodes where that would really fit. But unfortunately, the TNG writers did not do that, because they still, even after like 7 seasons, didn't really know what to do with Troy most of the time.
Yeah, that seemed to be the big problem with her character.
And I also want to comment, as she said in the email, it's true that the legal definitions of, you know, various psychiatric terms and the actual psychiatric definition of them are often very different. And my understanding is that there is no psychiatric definition of psychopathy. I think that that is a term that exists purely in pop culture and in legal writing, because it gets used to cover when a person commits a crime just to commit the crime. Right, like when a serial killer murders a bunch of prostitutes just because he wanted to murder a bunch of prostitutes, not for any financial gain or for any other reason, we call that person a psychopath. And it's like, and that's, but there's not like a diagnosis for it. We don't know what causes that. We're diagnosing symptoms, not an actual cause. At least that's my.
Maybe we should get another expert in here on the show to help clear that up.
We definitely could, and we could probably get Elise back on. She also has a psychology degree, but that's
well,
my
hot damn, man, let's do that.
Like, I need another reason to get Elise back in here. Oh, so we'll get on that. But for right now, we have one more email, and it is a voicemail from Dave Logan. David, can you go ahead and play that for us?
Yep, here we go.
Direct from the database in Bremerton, Washington, it's Data Logan's data log.
One is my name. The other is not.
2014, July 23. I just had a few points to share with you about, you know, some of your more recent episodes, and all these points, unfortunately, all have to do with the unsavory topic of forced sexual interactions of some sort. In the episode you did about Crime and Punishment, I think the lawyer guest you had on mentioned that Star Trek didn't really do anything about rape itself. I don't think that's true. I think certainly in later Trek, like in the 90s on, Star Trek didn't talk about rape directly. It talked about other forms of assault or allusions to rape. But in the first season of Next Gen, when Tasha Yar was on board, you know, there were still these allusions to Tasha growing up on a planet that had rape gangs. And in the original series, rape shows up quite a lot. I mean, obviously they can't show everything in a 60s television show, but they were incredibly brave, I think. Way more brave than the later incarnations of Star Trek when it came to showing this kind of stuff. And it's definitely obvious what they're talking about to an adult observer of the show. Some of the examples I remember off the top of my head, in A Private Little War, Nona was raped, or about to be raped, before she got killed. In The Gamesters of Triskelion, it's pretty clear that Uhura got raped, and she was in a cell, like, right across the corridor from Kirk. So Kirk was witnessing this, or at least hearing it going on. And it was a big climactic thing that happened right before a commercial break. But then they come back from the commercial break, and there's no mention of it, right? See, they went as far as they could in a 60s television show to say, yep, she absolutely got raped, but we can't really talk about it. so you don't know what happened with it or how she dealt with it. And then, of course, the biggest episode from the original series dealing with that topic is The Enemy Within, when Kirk is split into two forms, and the more id form of himself goes and attempts rape on Yeoman Ran. And in that episode, you do see the after effects and how she was dealing with it. But in a weird sci-fi situation where she both knew who the assailant was, and at the same time, within a short time period after the assault, the assailant didn't really exist anymore because he had merged with the other half of Kirk to make a new person who wasn't the person who had attempted to rape her. I definitely think the illusion that is in a lot of episodes that mind melds are like sex is definitely intentional, and it makes sense. It's a very intimate thing. And certainly sex is sometimes seen as a form of communication, but not generally a really detailed communication where you can get a lot of different information. It's more of a general, you know, I like you or I don't like you kind of information that comes across in normal sex. But the mind meld has that unique twist that you can get really complicated information conveyed during a mind meld. And so it actually has, in addition to its personal and really sexual side, it also has this very practical side, which makes it a unique animal and means that, for instance, in Star Trek VI, when Spock forces a mind meld in order to get vital information, then maybe there's reasons to say that it might actually be, at least in part, a laudable act for him to do that because he's saving who knows how many people from violence that might ensue if the Klingons and the Federation continued on their path to war. But of course, that's certainly an entire different debatable argument about whether an immoral act can lead to a moral outcome. Do the ends justify the means kind of thing. Then the one last little point I had about Vulcans. You talked a bit in your episode about marriage about the Vulcans having arranged marriages. It seemed to me to be one of the more logical things about their society, because if you have a society where people will die if they don't have sex at certain times, it seems natural that their society would evolve to make sure people partner up. Obviously, in the modern age, there's other techniques to deal with this. You can just easily go into a properly programmed holodeck and fake your body into thinking that you're actually having sex, and it works, which is great. But in the past, there wasn't that avenue, so the Vulcans really did need to ensure that all their people were coupled in an appropriate, safe manner, so that people wouldn't die, or so you can assure your society wouldn't suddenly have to deal with rape violence every once in a while. And again, sorry about all the somber discussion points here. It's not exactly a fun topic. Data out.
And we're back.
All right. So thank you, Data Logan, for sending us that. I want to... There's a couple of points you raised that I wanted to address because I think they were interesting. So I think what Elise meant when she said that, like, Star Trek doesn't really talk about rape is that even though it is sort of been featured once or twice, they don't really ever address it. Like you brought up a private little war in which the character is, I forget her name, but the sort of the witch doctor character is threatened with sexual assault, and then she ends up dying instead. And I really didn't like that. I thought it didn't make any sense to me that this character who was absolutely terrifying and had, like, all this power would suddenly just crumple when a bunch of guys were, like, threatening her and being all skeezy. I think she would have stabbed them, personally.
That's just how, you know, women, even the bad, scary guys, work.
Yeah, it just didn't make... That scene in particular didn't make sense, but, like... And then, like, in the Gamesters of Triskelion, I really thought that was a very bad way to do it, because they sort of, like, imply that Uhura is being attacked because she, like, has this blood-curdling scream, and then at the beginning of the commercial break, and then at the end of the commercial break, it's like, oh, apparently nothing happened. Like, Uhura seems fine, she doesn't seem upset or to have been hurt or anything, and it's just, that just felt like a false way to get you to come back after the commercial break, honestly. It just seemed like
kind of a manipulative way to do it also.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you're going to have that happen, you should, you know, you should embrace it. You should realize that there are going to be consequences to that, and you should, you know, deal with them. Just throwing it in there randomly, I thought was kind of upsetting. And then, of course, the episode where they really do deal with attempted sexual assault is The Enemy Within, which has a lot of its own problems, like how at the end Spock is ribbing Rand for being like, man, weren't you attracted to that guy who attacked you? And he's like, really, Spock?
Ew.
Yeah, it was gross. Now, talking about mind melds, you brought up the mind meld scene in Star Trek VI is very interesting and in some ways very unfortunate. Now, it occurs to me, I'll run this by the two of you, see what you think. I've always felt that, to me, it made sense for Spock to use the mind meld. He's used it before to get information from people who didn't want to give the information, and it seemed kind of like the early stages of the mind meld are not terribly invasive. But he reaches this point where he's like pushing, and clearly she is in a lot of pain. And
right.
That's the part where he's trying to find out where is the peace conference. And at first they're like, they seem to be going with the idea that she doesn't want to tell them, but in reality she doesn't know. And that's when it gets like really bad. And to me, that's the part where it really steps over the line. I was surprised that Spock would do that. That he would, you know, basically torture this woman. Like, this is, you know, not very far removed from what we have so euphemistically dubbed enhanced interrogation techniques, where we are inflicting pain on someone to try to get them to tell us stuff they don't want to tell us.
Right.
Well, and if you look at the way it's portrayed, like the way it's acted out for both sides, and most of the time when we think of the Vulcan mind meld, you know, they put one of their hands on your face and, you know, certain parts of the cheek and the forehead and whatever, and that's the mind meld. And that's what was going on when she was like, when they were saying, like, who's doing this? And it was like Admiral Cartwright, you know, the conspirators. When it got to the point of who, like, where is it, he like started moving his fingers around, like maybe he's probing different nerve clusters or whatever he's doing, still nothing. And then here comes the second hand. And there's times where, you know, I've done it, and other people, it's like, whoa, like making light of it, like, oh, it's a two-hander. But at the same time, if you really think about it, right, I know, that's not good. Because if you really think about it, the premise is that there's like, you know, energy and electricity and, you know, chi, or however you want to describe it, going through the hand to the other person back and forth. So if you apply a second hand, that's like, you know, doubling the amount of energy and electricity and all that. That made me think like
turning the brain probiness up to 11. Yeah.
Yeah. Either a deeper probe or a stronger amount of it. But the thing of it was, at that point, she's reacting like, you know, holy crap. And, you know, she's, you know, vocalizing like it's painful. But then when they stop and Spock is saying she does not know, he doesn't look very happy either. It seems to have affected him as well. And it wasn't just like he did it and he's like, oh, she don't know, we got to figure something else out now. He was like, he was affected by it.
Like, it's also hurt Spock to have to do this.
Right. And when I took it that way, it's like on both levels of like physically and mental, you know, the biochemistry of it, but also the fact that he had to go that far. And why, like, when I would think about that, it's like, why would Spock basically do that? Like, you know, violate on one hand, but also like go extra with the amount of it. And I took it as not just the ends justify the means, but in a Vulcan way, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. So like, he probably wouldn't have wanted to do that, but because so much was at stake for lives of people, you know, planets and populations, he had to sacrifice his comfort or his, you know, preference of not doing it. Cause there was a larger thing at stake. And, you know, on any other day, he wouldn't want to do that to her. He wouldn't want to have to take that step for himself. But the needs of the many outweigh.
But you got to wonder if that was added in there to try and make Shins more acceptable to the viewer and more palatable. Like, Spock did this awful thing, but he feels bad about it.
Yeah.
That's one thing that I can never stop wondering when I watch that scene.
Yeah, and here's the thing about it that is even more annoying is that they didn't even need to do that, because when they're like, she doesn't know, Kirk's like, oh, call Sulu. He'll tell us. And it's like, really? Because you could almost argue...
Why didn't they just do that first?
Right, that's my question. I mean, like, the information they got from her that was valuable was who are the conspirators. Like, they needed to know that, right? But then they get to the point where she isn't willing to get... Like, Kirk's asking, where is the peace conference? And she's not saying, and they are under the impression it's because she doesn't want to say. Now, it turns out she doesn't know. But then after she doesn't know, he's like, oh, we'll call Sulu. And it's like, you guys probably just should have done that when Spock should have been like, I can't go any further without causing, you know, damage. In the same way that you can interrogate someone, and then you get to the point where they won't tell you anymore unless you start punching them in the face. You know, if you have a way to
get
the information.
And then they'll tell you anything, yeah.
Right, and you have a way, and you could even almost argue, I don't think this was the intention, but you could almost argue that that scene is a commentary on the ineffectiveness of torture.
Well, the whole thing is supposed to be about, you know, the war and the underhanded dealings that go with it, so it could be, for all we know.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. Out of curiosity, can you guys hear a fan that just got turned on over here? Can you guys hear that coming out of my microphone?
Nope.
No, okay. I didn't hear it.
Well, that's good. I won't bother about it then. So I feel like that scene could have been better explored, and maybe, you know, not gone as far as it did, because I don't think it actually made any sense with what they showed us. But the last thing that Data Logan brought up that I wanted to discuss a little bit more were the forced marriages. I'm going to call them forced marriages now, because I feel like there needs to be a distinction between what they do there and what some cultures do, where they will do, like, you know, we talked about last week what they do in India, where it's in a, like, most of the time, I'm sure there are forced marriages there too, but there it's generally arranged marriages, where it's arranged but both parties have a veto. They can say no if they don't want to, whereas in Vulcan it doesn't seem like you have that option. And, like, the more I think about it, the more it seems completely illogical to me. I just don't buy it, because if the idea is, well, we want to make sure that nobody dies from the pond far, it's like, you know, prostitutes, like, pay someone to have sex with your men who are about to die from the pond far. It's not that hard, and, you know, it would save you a lot of these arranged marriages that are not going to go very well. And it seems odd that no one has, you know, just if you're going at it from a purely logical perspective,
Oren, that as a science fiction trope, space geishas hadn't been invented yet.
That's true. They, you know, they had not gotten the, you know, the Companions Guild hadn't yet been, you know, been formalized.
Space geishas in space.
I could have seen this working if they had explored it more and shown some Vulcans being like, hey, this whole arranged marriage thing we do is illogical. We don't have to do it this way. There are other ways that don't, because the implication that they give us in that episode is kind of that, because they sort of establish, it's not until, like, late Enterprise that we even get the implication that that Vulcan women also go through the Pon Farr. So it's this idea that Vulcan men have to have sex every 7 years or they'll die. And because of that, Vulcan women just have to be on standby to get married. And,
well, that sounds a little familiar, like the idea that men are just sexual creatures and it's the prerogative of women to make sure they are satisfied in that sense.
Yeah, it just seems like there are more efficient ways to handle that. Like, if really all it is about keeping someone from dying through the Pon Farr, like, surely you could set up a one-night stand. Like, you only have to do it once every 7 years. It doesn't sound that hard, especially as he pointed out with Holodex. Like, it's even easier at that point.
You don't even need a real live space geisha, then. You can just, you know, program one.
All right. So, you know, we're getting in the chat room that people can actually hear this fan that turned on here. So I need you guys to vamp for just a second. I'll be right back.
Vamping, you say? I think I can do that. You think you can do that, David?
Possibly. I need to maybe change my outfit, but to get more vampy.
Put on some higher boots. Put on some fishnets. Luckily, these are things I'm constantly wearing at all times, so I'm prepared.
Are we going to sing Let's Do the Trans Warp again?
I got that joke. But no, we need to stay Trek-focused. What's a good song we can do that's Trek-focused and sexy?
Okay, all right, I'm back. I've saved you guys all from whatever it was that Grace was about to do.
Crap!
All right. So I think so. Now we've got about 20 minutes left because we had to answer all those emails. So I want to talk about the new episode of Star Trek Continues, which is the fairest of them all. That is our technically our main topic for today, but it turned out our main topic was answering emails.
It happens.
So you guys have seen this episode, yes?
Uh huh.
Yep.
All right. So this episode is put out by Vic Mignogna, the guy in charge of the production of Star Trek Continues, and
the Vic Man.
Yeah,
who he's been on the Man Mignogna. I don't know.
It's very good, Grace. Here, I don't know what you were doing there, but I liked it. And so this episode, and there are going to be spoilers here because we can't really talk about it without spoilers, but it's very good. So if you want to listen to it without spoilers, I would recommend you go watch it now and come back to listen to the rest of this later. But I'm also saying that regardless of what we say here, the episode will be just as much fun to watch. Like, I watched it twice and it was just as fun the second time. So I will ask you guys first, before I go into my spiel, what did you guys think of this episode? Grace, you first.
I thought it was definitely an interesting concept. Again, of the two episodes I've seen them do, it's kind of a follow-up to a previous episode of the original series, which I think is good on one hand because it gives them something more to work with. It gives them a backstory, something to follow up on. But I would like to see them kind of try and do something a little different, do something original. I thought they definitely followed with the continuing sort of camp factor of the original series that they've been doing, which was great because they're really able to emulate the way the sets look, the costuming, the lighting, the sort of dramatic flair to the whole thing. But at the same time, I'm not sure if it lends itself that well to a dramatic story like this. Like, it was something they should have eased off of a little bit to emphasize the story because it was a very it was a very people interacting kind of story and not such a flash, boom, bang episode. But it was an interesting concept. I was interested in seeing what they were going to do with it. And I thought they made it interesting. They made it interesting in how they followed up to the previous episode. And I got to say, there were some like minor interactions in there, just little details thrown in that I really liked. Like, there's a point where they're talking and they're like, oh, yeah, this person's betrayed us. And you see some people in the background, like, exchanging money like they were betting on it or, yeah, just stuff like that. There are little details that kind of just made me be like, oh, I see what they did there. But I think my all-time favorite bit out of it was we have a scene where Kirk comes back to his quarters and he's kind of, you know, terrorizing his girlfriend and being like, oh, so there was another Kirk here. I wonder if he shared more than just my command. And she gets what he's implying. He's kind of like, oh, and he looks at her and goes, not funny. And I think that was my favorite thing of all time, just getting to see Vic Mignogna dressed as evil Captain Kirk going, that alone was worth it to watch and cheer. Just kind of, wow, this is what I'm watching right now. It was a great little moment, and it was funny and playful and dark. Vic does dark pretty well, I gotta say. But yeah, it wasn't, I felt like they could have done, again, I felt like it was a little more campy than it needed to be, but I'm still glad they did it. It was interesting to watch.
So your biggest problem with it, it sounds like, is that it was too much like TOS is kind of, I think what I'm getting from you here.
Not necessarily. Like I said, they emulate the style of TOS really well, but this is a pretty dark, they got kind of dark with it. And I felt like that kind of, the dark of the story they were trying to tell and the camp of how they were trying to sell it just didn't lend itself to it that well.
Hmm. David, how about you?
Oh, also, I loved seeing some of the new crazy 60s hairstyles they have added to more people on the show.
Fair enough.
And that those enormous 60s false eyelashes are now standard issue on the evil Enterprise.
Just pass those out. You get one when you come on board.
Oh yeah, they're like free toothpicks over there for your eyelids.
David, what did you think about it?
Well, overall, I enjoyed it. I'd have to say for what this is, for what they do, it was well done. It was an interesting concept to see, not because like in the previous one of the previous episodes, they continued after like a continuation of a previous TOS episode where it kind of just picked up later on from where that episode left off. Where this one, it's kind of like the flip side of it. You know, it's dealing with the mirror universe, and we see what happens in our, what would be, we would call the prime universe. This episode is like seeing the repercussions of what, of that episode in the mirror universe. So, and then, you know, so that's interesting to see what happens on the other side, or the aftermath, or the repercussion type thing. I still enjoyed it overall, but in I kind of can understand and agree with Grace somewhat, because they, on so many levels, it's TOS. I mean, especially with the remastered TOS, like the Enterprise shots, you think I'm watching TOS. And then when they're walking around the ship, the sets and the outfits and everything is like so well done that you're thinking...
They really captured that colorful theatrical look of the original series.
Right. The wardrobe, the costuming, the makeup, but the lighting, and there's all the different sound effects, and everything sounds is so spot on that it's TOS basically. But then for me, there's times where either a character or an actor or just the dialogue takes me out of it. And I'm trying to get over that, but at the same time, certain characters I could just go with. Like Chris Doohan as Scotty, I'm good with that. Like, I know it's not James Doohan, it's a different actor. You know, some of the other characters, I just buy them, okay. And it gets to the point where early on I would feel like, don't do Captain Kirk and Spock. Do exactly the same show you're doing, but give us like the USS Yorktown. Like, give us other stories, like another ship, new crew, and we can connect with those characters and not always have to think he's doing a Shatner impersonation or not. Because Vic is doing a good job as Kirk. He's not trying to do Shatner's mannerisms and impression. So that's good. You know, like I said, Scotty, Chris Duan is doing a good job. But then there's other characters where I just... As much as I want to, and I try to, you know, in purposely, intentionally suspend disbelief or just go with it, I can't really buy the Spock too as well. And then there's other characters that, and I'm sorry, I hate to say this because I love Grant Imahara, but I just can't. Every time Sulu, he's on a Sulu scene, I'm taken out of the story, because I love Grant and I could accept him not just, oh, he's a Mythbuster. I could accept him as an actor and a character of, you know, in a role, but he's always doing a voice. You could tell that he's like, oh, there's certain actors, I don't want to name the actors in Hollywood, but there's always times you could tell they're not being natural. They're not being, you know, I'm acting now, you know, there's just times where it takes me out of it. And it's not just that. Other times it's dialogue. So it's just tough sometimes for me to watch these, because I have to like purposely put that out of my mind. And when it happens, I'm like, okay, just for that happened, I'll move on. And then there's other portions of the episodes where I'm just totally engrossed and I buy it, and it's, you know, it's Star Trek TOS. So some episodes are better than others. Some scenes are better than others, but overall I enjoyed it because it was a good premise. And like, it was kind of I don't know if I would say dark, but definitely like a heavy topic and some heavy acting by Vic and some of the Spock character. But overall, I'm getting over that slowly. And I think it is because there are other fan productions out there, but Vic is a good actor. You know, it's well written, and just all the other elements kind of help further it along. But I don't know. That's just my issue. I mean, I know other people don't think in that regard, but if there's been other fan productions, not just of Star Trek, but just in general, where it's like, I just can't watch it. Like, I'm sorry, I'm out. I'll never go back. This one, I keep coming back to it. So there's goodness to it, you know, and then I think they're even getting better over as time goes on. So I enjoyed it, and it was an interesting concept. Good special effects, Doug Drexler doing the ships and the planets, and you get to see the Enterprise launching a full volley of torpedoes, and that was fun.
But then, yeah, there's some fun effects there, definitely. Also, it looks like Vic is just having a lot of fun getting to be evil.
So this is perhaps an unusual episode in which I liked something more than my two co-hosts did.
I know, right? It's We have entered the mirror universe here on All Things Trek.
Because I really liked this episode.
See it, but me and David both have goatees right now.
And I'm wearing a dagger on my hip.
I also have a bunch of children yelling and screaming outside of my apartment, if that's what you...
So we've heard.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted, you know...
Hang on, I'm going to go close the window. I'll be right back.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm not trying to bash on it, because that's just my personal issues. And it's not just this episode or this... you know, this episode or this production, Star Trek Continues, because I've watched other independent fan films, basically, like The Hunt for Gollum is a really cool fan film based on Lord of the Rings, and there's been other ones where
it's
like...
But that's kind of the risk you take with doing a fan production, though. You have to emulate a lot of style and a lot of finesse, but at the same time, you have to make it be something new, but maintain that feeling of not being like, hang on, but this isn't the same as the first one, that kind of thing.
I think the bigger risk is not just recreating that world or that environment, but the actual characters. I mean, and it's not just based on fan films. You know, look at the JJ universe, and we have Hollywood-trained, professional Hollywood actors, and some people just don't buy Chris Pine as Captain Kirk. Others love him as Captain Kirk, and others are just like, yeah, okay, it is what it is. You know, no real pro, you know, like or dislike for it. And at the same time, the Star Trek characters, Kirk, Spock, all that, it's not that they should be locked into, well, it should only be DeForest Kelly and them, because it gets to a point where Kirk, Spock, all the crew, even, you know, further on down the road, it would be like, you know, Picard and everything. They could be like Sherlock Holmes or James Bond or Hamlet, where multiple actors are going to go through the process of presenting a story or a certain take on, here's another look at Captain Kirk or another portrayal or another vibe or whatever. So I'm not just saying...
Right, but again, that's one of the risks you take when you're doing a fan production of something that's already established. You have to be able to say that you put your own spin on it and added something to it rather than just doing nothing but try to emulate the original.
Right. Well, and there's another fan film production out there, the Farragut series. And that's they're not doing Kirk and Spock. They're doing the same TOS. It's the USS Farragut. And to me, I like that because it's like, I love Kirk and Spock. Obviously, I want more Kirk and Spock, and we can't have Shatner go back in time and be the classic Kirk, but so I do want more Kirk stories, and that's why a lot of us read the novels, and, you know, and Vic is doing a good job as Kirk. And I'm like, I don't know about this, but I watched episodes, and now I could see his version of Kirk, like him, his Kirk. But at the same time, there's so many other ships out there. There would be the USS Defiant that we saw on TOS. Like, I want some stories about the Defiant. I want some Yorktown. I want, you know, it's like there's so much to the world and the universe that there's room for, like, more characters. Like, you know, we love seeing Spock and he's Vulcan and there's all that. But give us an Andorian person, or give us more of, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's tricky.
You want to see more expansion?
Well, and I can totally empathize with that, and to a certain extent, I actually agree. It's like, I think that remaking the original TOS crew over and over again presents a lot of problems, particularly with the inclusion of women. Because it's not that there weren't women in TOS, there were, but there is such a large male cast that if you don't put any of them in, people will be upset, because it's like, you know, hey, where's Chekhov? Where's Sulu? Where's Scotty? And so you have to include all of them and then find room to put women in, because otherwise you have this ridiculous imbalance of like seven guys and one female. And that's so, and you could solve that by just doing a different crew that isn't so weighted towards men. So I understand what you're going with there, David. But I think that, like, for me, I was looking at this as is basically, like, you know, like you guys said, to me, this is kind of like a different production, a different production company doing Shakespeare. Like, I've not had too much of a problem just accepting that that's not William Shatner, and that's not Leonard Nimoy. Those are, you know, they're playing characters rather than imitating actors. I was actually thinking that I thought Todd Haberkorn really came into his own as Spock in this episode. Like, in the previous two, I didn't think he had a whole lot to do, and I wasn't quite buying him. But in this episode, I thought he did a really good job, and I thought that Vic was fantastic as evil Kirk.
Like, now, and that's the thing. I don't have an issue with Todd's acting, and I think he does a good job. It's just, to me, I'm not thinking about Leonard Nimoy so much as the character of Spock. Now, and this is weird to me when because at first I was like, I can't put my finger on it. But then at one point when I was watching another episode, I'm like, light bulb moment. It's like, to me, Todd does a very good Vulcan, but it feels to me more closer to Tuvok than Spock. And it's just like the demeanor, the attitude, the body language, everything about it just doesn't say Spock to me. It's a good Vulcan. It's a great Vulcan. But there was that moment where it's like, he seems more like Tuvok to me than actually Spock. But it's just a different take. And not like like we were saying, not every Hamlet will act the same and have the same demeanor and everything. So, like I said, I'm getting over that. And I'm able to accept, get inside the episodes more. And this was a good story. It was well-paced, moved along. And so I enjoyed it.
Also, just for the record, I kind of missed seeing Larry Nemechek in there.
Yeah, this new McCoy, he didn't really do very much. I think he had like two lines in this episode.
He had one scene, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not going to pass any judgment on him because we haven't really seen him much, but I already miss Larry.
Well, actually, this McCoy is the original McCoy. They did a few, like, preview vignettes, and he was their first original McCoy for this, and then for some reason he couldn't continue doing it or had, like, other assignments or engagements or something. And so Larry stepped in, and he did a great job. He shaved his beard, which was like monumental. And then after two episodes, he wanted to get back to his Trek land and other, activities that he's doing. And so the original Bones was able to come back.
That's true. So you could even say that he is the real McCoy. I've been saving that joke for like 5 years, and I finally
we
had
know,
a chance to use
we
it.
We know, and we could feel it. We had to let it out.
Oh, did you guys notice something else? In this episode, we had a computer Worf.
Yeah, that was the other thing.
I did not notice that.
Yeah, the Enterprise computer is voiced by Michael Dorn.
Oh!
Yep.
Well, what do you know?
Which was kind of neat. I mean, it didn't really have a big impact on the episode, but I enjoyed it. And one thing that I'll say for this episode is that it really scratched an itch that I've wanted to have scratched for a long time. Because the Mirror Universe, as it was first introduced, I really liked it in TOS. And then, unfortunately, one of the few things about Deep Space Nine I don't like is every time Deep Space Nine brought in the Mirror Universe, I think it just got worse. So I've wanted to see another Mirror Universe story, and they kind of did this with Enterprise a little bit. I liked the Mirror Darkly episode of Enterprise, but I wanted to see
theme music.
Yeah. Like, I wanted to see more of an exploration of the Mirror Universe, especially with what Spock put, with what Kirk put in Spock's head. Like, I wanted to see how that played out. And, I thought this was a very good way of exploring it. There were some things about it that were actually, they bothered me because they were too much like what TOS does a fair bit, like auxiliary control. I'm not a big fan. It's like, why do we even have the normal bridge when we have this other room, which is like bridge plus one, right? It's like,
Next Generation has the battle bridge. I mean, there's always a secondary. Like, what happens if the bridge gets blowed up or destroyed? You got to have a secondary place to control the ship.
It's right, just that's not what I mean. I understand you need a second place to control the bridge, to control the ship. What I want to know is why being on the secondary bridge gives you the ability to override the primary bridge.
Why is the second bridge more powerful?
It's not. It's the fact that Scotty joined Spock, and they went to the auxiliary control, and Scotty worked his magic and rerouted and locked out and everything. So it's like the times when Data would pretend he's Picard's voice and lock out the computer, and they're like, we can't get this because, like in the episode Brothers, where Data got the homing signal and had to go back to visit Noonien and Soong, and they're like, we can't we got this kid who's sick in sickbay, the boy in the bubble, but we can't go to the starbase where he's needing help because Data locked us all out, and we're going to the. It's Scotty. Scotty did his magic and, trumped the bridge by making it all happen from the auxiliary.
That's a better explanation than anything I'd thought of. is that it was really just Scotty doing it. But there are other episodes of TOS where, like, the space hippies are able to take control of the Enterprise just by going to the backup bridge. And it, the implication
space
I
always... Space hippies.
So I'll actually buy... I'll retract my criticism.
Herbert.
I'll actually...
Herbert.
I'll buy that it makes sense that because they had the chief engineer on their side, they were able to out-tech the bridge. Because the people on the bridge were Kirk, the helmswoman, and Uhura, who is... All three of them are competent at their jobs, but none of them are the technicians. So I will accept that. That makes sense. We are almost at the end of our time, because I know, Grace, you have to go. But the last thing that I wanted to discuss was the line that they repeated several times throughout the episode was that in every revolution, there is one man with a vision, which is something else. Again, they got that from the TOS episode. But it occurs to me, although I appreciate the sentiment that you need to have, like, you know, change can start with one person who has the courage to try something. It occurs to me that in real revolutions, what you usually end up with is a lot of people with visions. And if, you know, then they can't, if they, they either have to get them to, like, they either have to get all their visions to work together or the revolution falls apart, right? Like, that seems to be more how it actually works. Am I the only one who was thinking about that?
Well, but we see that in through the course of the episode, Spock is the first one to, you know, take to heart what their Prime Kirk was telling him about the logic of this, you know, is going to have a certain outcome and it'd be better to do, you know, to not do it this way for... So, yeah, Spock was the first one, but he recruited... he started recruiting along the way. And it's, and not just partly...
He was a busy little bee.
And partly it was like a philosophical thing, like, you know, using the logic. But in the case of, like, Chekhov, he was getting thrown into the agony booth left and right. So when Spock is like, hey, maybe we shouldn't do this, I'm obviously Chekhov is going to be like, yeah, let's not throw people in the agony booth.
Yeah,
sort of like Arthur, we let him go kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I can see Chekhov would be all for an anti agony booth policy. But all right, so we are out of time for today. Thank you both for joining me in our discussion of our emails and in this this brief recap of the fairest of them all from Star Trek Continues. I will once again say that I heartily recommend it. I think it's very good and it's worth your time to watch.
Yep, definitely check it out.
So next week we will be back. I don't know what we'll be talking about, but I'm sure we'll come up with something. And until then, this will be All Things Trek signing off.